8:35 this morning here at KGNU, your community radio station. Sitting with me in the studio today is Pedro Silva. If you know him, you know he's worn many hats. Welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Pedro, I have been chasing you for a long time. I'm so excited to have you here. Welcome to Storytellers this morning, listeners. Here we are. And it is unique, you know? It is super unique to have the presence of Pedro Silva here in the studios because you are a busy person. You listeners already know Pedro Silva has served in the U.S. Air Force. Later, he has become a corporate recruiter and a pastor with the United Church of Christ. And today, he's the director of engagement at Unify. Through all these roles, one thing has been consistent: your commitment to bridging divides and creating spaces of belonging. And here in Boulder County, you have also been deeply involved in civic life, working on affordable housing, racial equity, and now stepping into even comedy as another way to bring people together.
Yep.
So, you know, our listeners are going to get like an amazing storytelling today about all these hats and the need to come together. Welcome to the studios. I think that we should just, you know, jump in the conversation because I remember that I first connected with you years ago during a period when our local immigrant communities faced challenging times from 2016 to 2020, as you know, and now. The sense of fear and disconnection only grew during the pandemic. Then we had also the Black Lives Matter movement. I remember seeing you, walking with you, standing strong. And then we had also devastating fires and mass shootings. And they continue. And over the years, I have seen you, Pedro, in different roles and always leaning into community. And I knew I wanted to bring your story here to Storytellers of Color. So I'm just having a good time. Pedro, I've seen you in many facets over the years, and especially during moments when, as you know, our immigrant communities felt the most vulnerable. How did those experiences shape your view on community and belonging? And tell us, how did you get where you are now?
I should start with the fact that I have a very complex racial and relational background. My father was an immigrant. And so I had a first generation experience in America, but then also my mom's a very complex black Jewish like person. And I grew up in what some people call the hood. So growing up in that context, there was this very stark contrast between the haves and the have nots, or the black and the white. And what happened was my dad and my mom divorced, and he married a white woman who was a poor white woman who lived in a trailer park. And so at an early age, I had to navigate all these complexities with people from all walks of life. And doing that at a really early age, it was my normal. Like, my normal was I would go, and then top it off, I had Muslim family too. So there were times where I would go to a mosque, go to a Christian church, go to like a synagogue, go to like to the trailer parks and hear some very interesting ways of seeing the world. That was always just like a part of my life. And then once I started going to school and people started to break into their different groups, I realized that I had all of these relationships within me, but I couldn't carry all of my relationships into those different spaces with folks. And I found myself sometimes not trying to make excuses for people from different backgrounds, but explaining my perspective and saying, oh, well, I know you said that about this person, but my cousin's a Muslim and blah, blah, blah. Or I know, man, they did sound kind of ignorant when they said that, but the perspective that I think they have is blank, you know. And then because people didn't talk to each other, that energy would usually come back at me. So if I said something on behalf of somebody from, let's say, the LGBTQ plus community, then someone who never talked to a person from that community would take their vitriol out on me because I was like the closest access they had, because they weren't going to cross those lines. And so eventually I started to think Oh, people used to tell me I was a bridger, or I was a bridge, and I used to not like it, actually. I would say I'm not a bridge because bridges get walked over, and I'm not trying to get walked over. And I would try to invite them to, go meet people. And then as I continued to kind of navigate this space, I started realizing the power of story and how if you just like there's this thing in sales where they say facts sell, tell and stories sell. And so once I started realizing the power of story, I started thinking to myself, like, you know what? How can I use story to kind of create a larger context for people? So even though a person might not go meet a person in person, like directly, they might watch a movie about it, they might read a book about it, they might listen to a song about it. And that's the way I can create some kind of proximity. And so I started to do that. And then I've been just increasing that over the years, looking at different ways of articulating things. So I write music, I do comedy, I preach, but it's all trying to kind of expand the context. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And a lot of times I'm just living into the mystery. Like I get an invitation, I accept. It's kind of like almost like improv, like in improv comedy, it's like yes and. So when something shows up, you just say yes to it and then you go with it, you add to it. And that's basically what I do with my life. It's almost like an improvisation where I'll be like, okay, yes and. Like I became a pastor, I wasn't asking to be a pastor. I had a couple of things that happened in my life. I said yes, and I ended up in seminary. Then I went right back to corporate, not planning on being a pastor. Came to vacation in Boulder, walked into a church. They weren't looking for anybody. A couple of weeks later, two people resigned, and then they had seen me at a church. My wife had told somebody I had a seminary degree. I was living in Massachusetts, and I got a Facebook friend request from the former pastor, who said, "Hey, are you looking for the opportunity to be a pastor?" And I was like, "Well, not really." And then she said, "Well, we have this thing going on for 1 year." And I said, "Oh, I could do it for a year." And I talked to my wife about it, came here for what I thought was a year and never left. So, but it was just a yes and, yes and, yes and. So that's pretty much sums up how I live.
And that's the reason you are my perfect guest for Storytellers of Color, where we highlight BIPOC creativity. You know, those media makers, those people that are out of the box and don't get featured normally in, as you know, it's very difficult for our communities to really show up as the artists that we are, even though Latino music is all over, or our dances as, you know, African American, that is in our blood. It is very difficult. And as you know, things have been changing, but still there's not the spotlight on our lives. And I had the opportunity, since I have been also been supporting the efforts to bring more diverse voices into One Small Step, the StoryCorps project we have been so honored to have at KJNU. I have been reconnecting with you, Pedro. Reminded me just how much I value your work. And because I know it's not easy, but it is extremely necessary. It's not easy to bring diverse voices or people with diverse backgrounds together for a conversation, for finding a common humanity.
I mean, I think part of the struggle is part of the cure is also part of the struggle. I don't know if you heard, there's something like the cure is in the poison, it's a saying. And sometimes people kind of think that stories are in competition with each other instead of looking at it more as like a mosaic or more as a grand narrative. There's an in the There's a guy named Marshall Gantz who talks about narrative structure, and there's the story of self, the story of us, and the story of now, and then there's the superordinate story. And the superordinate story is the story that contains all stories. You can almost look at it like a library of sorts, right? When we go to the library, we don't look at different books as being in competition with each other. The library is a storehouse of or repository of knowledge, and all knowledge should be accessible in this library. And then people can go and they can look at different things, but when it comes to relational dynamics, a lot of humans think that their story is in competition with another person's story. So if someone tells themselves, oh, well, we're the greatest people that ever exist in the entire universe, then if you tell yourself that, anybody else that says, well, I've done some good things too, they're like, die. You know, how dare you say you've done good things? I've done all the great things that could be done ever. And when you have that kind of mindset, it kind of, well, one, it takes away from oneself, because no one is the greatest, you know, and no one is the worst. It's all a big mix of everything. That's what it means to be human. But a lot of times we treat our stories as if they're in competition with other stories. And when that happens, it's hard to bring people together. And unfortunately, even in the communities of color, there's a lot of those problems too, because like when I was a kid, having this name, my full name is Pedro Serena Ramos Montero Silva, right? So when I first started school, I didn't want anybody to know my name. I tried to come up with a nickname or something, because I knew when they heard my name, they were going to kind of like make jokes and just whatever. And the black kids and the white kids, especially where I lived in the South, there wasn't a lot of Latino people or any people from other countries. And my dad was Portuguese and Cape Verdean. And so when I went to school, they saw my name, Pedro. They just thought, well, that sounds like a Mexican name. That's the only name thing they could think of. And there was also at the time this magazine called Boy's Life. And the main character was a burro named Pedro. And so people would be like, oh, Pedro the burro, and you're a jack A or whatever. I don't know if you could say jackass. Well, I just said it. Anyway, but at any rate, but they would joke at that, you know, and they would literally tell me, Pedro, Pedro, go back to Mexico and all this other stuff like that, and joke me. And obviously that didn't feel good, but it also was kind of coming out of ignorance, you know, and lack of proximity. And people would try to make you choose. And even my immigrant family would try to make me choose between my black side, a black American side, and then the people from Cape Verde also many of them are African, you know, like it's a mix, like Afro-European mm-hmm. type of thing. But they would also want me to be like, oh, you're either this or that. And I'm like, how am I going to make that decision? But for myself, I just identify as black. I always have, because even when my dad, his driver's license said white. And my dad, when I was filling out my driver's license, he was looking over my shoulder. And I was like, what's this guy looking over my shoulder? And then he said, he said, I knew it when I put black. He said, I knew you were going to put that. And I was like, well, what do you want me to put? And then he said, well, mine says white. And then I said, well, first of all, you're not white. You know, you're just not. Just because you come from a country that at the time they identified as white, like, you're clearly not. You know, people would confuse him with being Middle Eastern. Mm-hmm. And I was like, he was just like, it's like you ignored my existence. And I was like, I don't ignore your existence, bro. I live in America, if you know what I mean. And I told him, and I said, Dad, look, here's the deal. If a police officer sees me and says, hey, is that guy's dad driver's license say white? Then I'll change my driver's license. Otherwise, if they look at me and call me something else, which you know what I'm talking about, then I'm gonna put black on my driver's license. And then my dad was like, oh, you're always being stupid. But it was like, his point of view was that he also took that proximity to whiteness as an advantage. And I always was like, Dad, like, you're letting your story be overrun by somebody else's story. And I want to do that. I want to have my story, you have your story, and we can create better stories together if we choose to.
8:50, the show is running with Pedro Silva this morning, our storytellers of color, and you're listening to KGNU. You have led also conversations on race, work with the NAACP, advised the Boulder Community Foundation after tragedy, and more recently you have turned to comedy as another way to connect people. Why comedy? What role do humor and joy play is helping people engage across differences?
Well, comedy is, the way I look at it is, you can only laugh at what you are either processing or have already processed. If you're still stuck, then you're not going to be able to laugh. But there's this formula for comedy. It's like tragedy plus time. So if something terrible happens or something difficult happens, with enough time, it becomes funny. And that's why if somebody says something, a joke about something, like we're coming up on 9/11, right? And I'm doing a show at CU with some other folks in the comedy space on September 11th. Right after September 11th, you could not tell any jokes about September 11th because they would say that was too soon. But now comedians will joke about September 11th if they have the skill to do that. That's just how humans evolve. Like we move through spaces, we move through time as we get out of the another formula I use is disaster plus distance. So like if we look across the world, there are people like if you have a distance from their disaster, you can make light of it. It's not always a great thing to do, but that's how humans function. And so I try to use comedy in a way that kind of pulls people into the awareness of how we function. I call my comedy style liberation comedy, and the whole point of it is to help people liberate these things that are stuck inside of them. And there's a lot of things that they frankly hurt. That's a part of being in this world. We're going to experience pain, we're going to experience suffering, but we're also going to experience relief from suffering, and then we're going to suffer again, and we'll experience relief from suffering again. And so as we learn that pattern and we learn to anticipate that pattern, then we can, it's not making light of it in the sense of diminishing it, but it's expanding it and making literally like almost a spiritual light. It's like we're bringing light, we're illuminating circumstances, and making things funny or showing how they can be funny is a way of doing that. Like I said a joke the other day at CU, and some of the students almost I kept joking because all the students were they were mostly white. So I would keep saying stuff like, "How many of y'all have a black mom from the South?" To blah blah blah, and then they would just kind of like, obviously there was none. And but then I did one joke, and first they were like shocked I said it, but I said that for people of color in America, or especially black people, our hope is always in the future, because that's just how it is. Like we have lived in the circumstances, our history emerged from a circumstance where the further back we go, the worse it gets, you know. So no one's gonna be looking back and saying, "I wish." I mean, some people might, but many black people, stuff like that, are not gonna look for the good old days in the past. Our better days are always ahead. And then as I was talking about that, I said, like, like right now, even though I do a lot of work, I'm still, you know, it's economically curious the way I choose to live my life because I'm always like doing projects here and there. But I joked about it and I said, "Well, I'm not gonna look back and say, 'Oh man, I wish it was 1823, because then I wouldn't have to look for a job because Massa would have had one for me." Right? And then everybody was like, "Oh." But I was saying it with shock and stuff to make the point that, like, hey, our futures, our thing is about the future. It's never gonna be in the past for us, you know? And that's something that it's like slavery's not funny, but if I point at the ridiculousness and stuff like that, it can like leverage it and make it more illuminated.
I love it how you have explained, because you know it also happens in my Latino community. I am a mestiza, I'm a mixed race, and the only way to really deal with the complexity of trying to always divide us, to conquer us, is by humor. It's the only way. But you are having an event. Can you please tell us what do you hope people walk away with when they have the experience of this comedy event that you're planning?
Well, I'm not planning. It's actually coming out of
Yeah, it's part
CU.
of.
I'm a
Okay,
part
tell
of
me.
it. I'm one of the comedians in it. Essentially, it's called Improv, which is basically improv and slash with an E on the side. And it's actually based in climate action. And so this is comedy that is trying to illuminate the climate crisis that we find ourselves in. And I actually got into comedy by way of a climate crisis. And so it's a good kind of full circle experience for me. But the folks who are putting it together over at CU, they have brought together, but mostly it's going to be improv. And so I'm still with improv, you don't know what's going to happen. So I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but what I hope people get out of it is that they can be at choice with what happens in our society, in our world, and with our planet. And when we do comedy, we show that we are at choice. We can choose to look at something painful, and as I said before, we can illuminate it with our laughter, but it also calls attention to it, you know. And people can say, like, "Oh my God," like we can joke about the apocalypse and things like that, and it makes people nervous. But we also know that when people laugh, they're breathing, they're releasing breath. And a lot of times our anxiety and our stress is from the stuck breath inside of us because of whatever has stressed us, whatever has brought fear to us, or those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. One thing I'll just kind of add tangentially is I was scheduled to do comedy at the Bone Shalom Synagogue right before the attack on Pearl Street. And that Friday, I was already scheduled to do comedy there. And I was like, when it happened, I was like, well, I'm assuming it's going to get canceled. But to their credit, they didn't cancel it. And we had a very interesting time because we sat with it. But we still laughed. We still felt emotions. And I hope that in anything where there's this tragedy or disaster, that we can figure out how to play with time and distance and bring laughter to the present moment so we can create a better future of choice as we kind of move through time and space together.
When is that event, a comedy event, happening? The date?
September 11th, 6 p.m. at the Loft Theater on CU's campus.
Wow. When you think about the future of our communities here in Boulder County and beyond, what gives you hope? And what role do you consider local media like KGNU and civic projects like One Small Step can play in making that vision real?
I think it comes back to, again, to story of helping us see that there is room for all of our stories. We all exist already. It's just being able to open ourselves to one another and to see ourselves in one another. You know, like right now, another thing I'm working on is the Boulder Valley Comprehensive Plan, which on September 9th, which is tomorrow, at Casey Middle School, there's an event, and it's going to be talking about land use, and people are going to be able to look at land use maps and look at existing neighborhoods, structures, and community hubs, and all these other things. And it's an opportunity for people to envision a future together. This, the Boulder Valley Comprehensive Plan, which we run into each other on this as well, is looking 20 years into the future. And as I said earlier, to me, people of color should always be, that's my opinion, we should always be investing in the future because that's where our greater hope is. And so I find hope in participating in things like this, learning from people, hearing their stories, seeing people get excited. And then I even find hope in getting discouraged, because sometimes I've gotten discouraged in this process because sometimes people will come to processes already biased, which I understand, but then they think, well, nothing's going to change. But we create our futures with the thoughts that we have. So if you think nothing's going to change, nothing's going to change. If you think you have choice and you can create a bigger world and a better world, and you get enough people involved in that powerful, more powerful story, that is also a possibility. And so I'll say, if I feel discouraged, I just face my discouragement, I flip it into encouragement, I joke about it, and then I just keep on going.
Wow. Oh, so inspirational. So, so inspirational. It's almost 9 here at KGNU, your community radio station. And we have been talking with Pedro Silva. And you have been listening to Storytellers of Color on KGNU. Ah, it has been a wonderful conversation with you, Pedro.
Thanks for having me.
And I just want to say, you know, thank you again for taking the time to come here. It's not easy in our busy schedules. And thank you again for all the service that you have been providing and fostering belonging more than anything. If you have missed part of today's program, you can listen again at kgnu.org. We're going to post a story for KGNU and Storytellers of Color. I'm Rosanna Longo. Thanks again for joining. And thank you, Pedro, for coming.